Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up this week.
Well, it's steady. It's been great, actually. The initial response was pretty overwhelming, and we struggled to keep up. It's between 30 and 50 every day.
Co-owner of Affinity App, Justin Duncliffe, they're explaining how his app, what his app does and the wonders it will have for time poor happy travellers. And we'll be giving you a rundown on what royalties are, given the context of what's happening with Adani and the Queensland Government, in our Word of the Week. All this and more coming up on The Money. Last week, the New South Wales government announced that they would privatise or franchise the buses running in Sydney's inner west and parts of the south as well. The government said that it would improve the efficiency of the services, as the area is to be privatised has received a large number of complaints. Publicly operated bus services in other parts of the country are also facing potential privatisation. But not everyone is convinced that a privately operated bus service will be a boon for the city. Stuart Prince, National Executive Officer at the Rail, Bus and Tram Union, spoke to Vincent Su, who explained why franchising is not always the best model to follow.
If you look at Victoria, where this business model has been in place since the late 90s, you can see that the outcomes are pretty sketchy. In fact, when the franchise model first came into place in Victoria under Jeff Kennett, it was completely unsustainable, and within 3 years, the contracts fell apart, and the BRACS government that came in 2002 had to renegotiate the contracts at a significantly higher cost to the taxpayer to bail them out. So to say that franchising is a success and that it delivers benefits really is basically a misinterpretation of history, and it's based on a lot of spin. And in fact, since 2003 in Victoria, when the franchises were renegotiated, the story hasn't got any better. In fact, I guess the proponents of franchising would say that since 2003, there's been a 40% growth in patronage and a 30% growth in the number of kilometres on the train network. But that's been coupled with a 63% increase in the cost of the contracts to the taxpayer. So it's not really providing value for money because the costs keep going up.
Well, on the other hand, the government has highlighted the case of Sydney Ferries as a model for buses, and in that case, the working conditions were all carried over to the new employees of a new ferry franchise with improved efficiency. So why wouldn't this model work for bus operations?
Well, it really depends on how the negotiations go with the new franchisee. So you really can't guarantee that a new franchisee is going to come in and pursue worker-friendly policies. It's being taken out of the government's control and put into the hands of a private company. And it may well be that to sweeten the deal, a company puts in place some guarantees for a period of time, and we've seen that with a number of privatisations where a new operator will come in and say we'll preserve certain conditions for a period of time. But when those guarantees run out, it's then open season. And in fact, in the rail sector, we saw that really quite graphically when the Queensland government privatised its freight operation, which was called Queensland Rail, and is now Aurizon. And Aurizon is now one of the most aggressive anti-worker employers that our union deals with. And in fact, last year, Aurizon was so aggressive that it terminated 12 enterprise agreements and tried to put its entire workforce back onto award conditions, which would have been like a 40% pay cut for many of our members.
But on the other hand, though, Aurizon, that was a case of full privatisation. In this case, we're talking about franchising, which is not exactly full privatisation.
Yeah, but in terms of how the employers managed their labour force, there's not much the government can do once the contract is over. I mean, with franchising, what you get is a level of control for the government where they contract the provider to provide certain services. There's usually nothing in those contracts that prescribe how they treat their workforce or where they can cut costs. So if an operator has to provide a certain number of services, it needs to be able to make a profit. So it'll try and find other ways to make money. And there's three ways that the franchisees can basically make money. One is to cut labour costs. The second is to try and cut maintenance costs. Or the third is literally and metaphorically to take shortcuts in services. So what we've seen in Victoria is that tram and train companies have actually taken to either skipping stations, in the case of the train operator, to try and make up some time and make up some money. And in the tram operator has this thing called short shunting, where they don't, if they're running behind, they don't even go to the end of the line.
I'm actually quite familiar with that in Sydney. I catch the M41 all the time from Macquarie Park, and sometimes it just ends at Burwood, even though it's supposed to go all the way to Hurstville. Isn't that also a case of government operators doing shortchanging the customer?
Well, it shouldn't happen. This is the point. And
can it happen under both private and government operator?
Well, I would argue that the private operators in Victoria have become notorious for it. In fact, Yarra Trams in March this year had 11,000 instances of short shunting. And that's like 350 times a day where the trams haven't even got to the end of the line. And they do that because they've made a calculation that the penalties for failing to reach the end of the line are less than the penalties they get for their performance benchmarks. And the customer experience just gets thrown out the window here. I mean, it's a terrible situation. It shouldn't happen under any operator. But our experience is that it's become chronic under private operators in these franchising agreements.
All right, well, one of the government's other arguments is that a private operator will help them institute efficiency changes in the bus operations. Isn't there an efficiency issue with delays in the existing operations?
Well, this argument's been put forward for the privatisation of the inner west buses, and the minister has been very strong in saying that he believes there have been too many complaints and a private operator will be able to cut down the number of complaints. And those complaints are essentially about late running buses. But that analysis is flawed on two levels. It's firstly, he's saying that there's 12,000 complaints and that's too many. Well, there are more trips in the inner city than there are in the outer suburbs. So if you're comparing inner city publicly operated buses with the buses in the outer suburbs, there's actually fewer complaints per trip than in the inner city than there are in the outer suburbs. So he's not taking into the fact that there are more trips taken in the inner city. The second reason he's wrong is that the traffic is obviously much worse in the inner city than it is in the outer suburbs where there are private buses running. So the argument that it's going to be more efficient and that somehow it'll be able to stick to the timetable better because it's run by a private operator is not based on fact. It's just based on mythology and assumption that private is better.
Well, you mentioned that buses are often delayed by traffic. One measure the government has tried to implement in Sydney is outdoor boarding. The government has said that it has helped reduce delays where it has been implemented. So that's to help compensate for the traffic delays. Is the union in favour of such efficiencies like this as a compromise?
Yeah, we're definitely in favour of measures that can improve services. And if we can make the customer experience better, then that's a great thing. It'll encourage more people to use public transport. But we would rather see the government taking the lead and making these improvements itself when it can control the services and putting on more employees to manage crowds. If there's more of an effort put into managing crushes, if there were more transit officers on the system to make sure that people were safe and to manage any situations that would occur, then there are all sorts of ways that you can actually improve the customer experience and encourage more people to use public transport. But we're saying that handing the lot over to a private operator who has a profit incentive to try and screw down costs and make as much money out of it as possible is not going to deliver those improvements. All it's going to do is actually diminish service, and in turn that'll push more people out of public transport and into private transport, and which then leads to more traffic congestion.
So apart from Sydney, Brisbane also operates one of Australia's largest publicly operated networks. Do you think that Brisbane buses will be watching developments in Sydney?
Oh, look, we've seen the trend of privatisation sort of creep across the country, and there's no doubt at all that we're facing potentially other operations being privatised, particularly where you have Liberal governments that have an obsession with this sort of thing. So in Brisbane, we've got a Liberal-controlled council, and we certainly want to make sure that the council keeps control of those buses and keeps operating them, because we think that that's the best outcome for the people of Brisbane. And a council-controlled bus service will deliver the best service for commuters.
Stuart Prince, National Executive Officer at the Rail, Bus and Tram Union, ending that report by Vincent Sue. You're listening to On the Money, where we're breaking down all the questions you have about business and money. We're broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney. I'm Roderick Chambers.
Please explain. Please explain.
Royalties are usage-based payments. It's typically a percentage, and often we hear about it in terms of music and mining. This week, Associate Professor Jason West digs deep to help us uncover what a mining royalty is.
In the context of Australia, a royalty is generally a fixed percentage based on the offtake price of ore or coal sold as an export.
And what's an offtake price?
The offtake price will be the price delivered at the port. So it is essentially the contracted or price paid by the customer at either a free on board price, which is the price at the Australian port, or the delivered price, which is the price delivered to the customer at their country.
We are really talking about a percentage of volume of product mined.
Yeah, basically it's a fixed percentage regardless of profitability.
State governments have the right to exact royalties from mining, and is one variable that they are able to increase without too much voter backlash.
So the royalty increases are fixed and must be paid regardless of profitability. So if your margin per tonne of coal is $10 and that royalty ends up being $10, then you have to pay it regardless of whether that that mine ends up being profitable or not. In contrast, the mining tax is a percentage of profitability, and so it represents a more efficient tax, and it permits the producers who are earning more to pay more tax, and those who are earning less to pay less tax or no tax, but still remain productive.
The mining tax works on balance sheet profits then, whereas royalties depend on the volume of stuff mined. Of course, in Australia, we don't want to make things too simple. So with the state government royalties and the federal mining tax, we have two types of tax that operate differently.
In the context of the Australian system, to have two types of taxes, royalties which are fixed and are non-negotiable, and the percentage-based royalty tax, which is similar to the corporation's tax, it represents an inefficiency, and you try to do two things at the same time, which are irreconcilable.
So have they set the royalties too high?
It's a little high. Given that 10%, for coal in particular, 10% of all sales of coal up to $100 is the resource royalty that has to be paid. And if you're a mine at a high cost of production, say at $80 a tonne, you're liable to pay a tax on that of $8, which sends your cost now to $88 a tonne. Look, if you're only achieving an $85 offtake contract, then you're losing $3 a tonne. And it sends the mine to an unprofitable state and therefore in line to either mothball the contract or cease production or look for a cheaper alternative to increase production and reduce costs. So it kind of kills those companies that are at the margin, whereas a resource rent tax, which is a percentage of profits, it doesn't necessarily do that.
Queensland may have upped the ante on royalties. And other states like Western Australia could be interested in increasing their royalties too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're sort of limited in their revenue-raising capacity, and the only way they can really tap into more revenue is to either cut their expenditure or increase royalty. And that's their... unless they can squeeze the federal government for more GST receipts, then the only real source of income for them is the royalties on minerals.
We'll explore musical royalties in the future. But for now, that was your Word of the Week.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
Frederick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcasters across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Well, new apps are always exciting, and it's good to hear that Australian developers are getting their fair share of the App Store pie. As people travel more and have less time in each destination, an app that tells you what is going on in your vicinity will be just the ticket if you've arrived in a new city. Of course, it would need to be tailored to your interests or affinities, and this is just what this app promises. I asked the co-owner of Affinity, Justin Duncliffe, what problem this solved for people.
Well, in regards to being somewhere that you're not aware of your surrounds, or you might not know anyone there or have any idea what's happening, so the problem it solves is it's an information tool in your pocket that shows you exactly what's happening right now around you based on your list of chosen affinities.
So what's an affinity? What sort of things are you looking at there?
Well, it's very broad. The selections are endless. So if anyone has any interest in anything, they can potentially choose that as one of their affinities. Things like live music, sport, adventure, travel, everything, absolutely everything. And if you're in rural Australia and you want to know if there's a country music festival on, or even just two-for-one chicken schnitzel, you'll go through your newsfeed, and if that's indeed what you're into, it'll show up there.
And you have affinities on affinity.
Yes. And you determine what it is that you have an affinity for, and all the information is there for you to see. It's a location-based device, so wherever your phone goes, you can set the radius to 5K, 50K, 100K, and so if you're going to Surfers Paradise next week and you want to see what's happening around you then, you're able to.
Well, that's a good idea because, you know, if you're somewhere with a car, your circle could be a lot bigger than if you're just on foot and have arrived at some railway station somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And you can really narrow it down and be specific. Okay, I just want to go to a restaurant. And you just type in food within a 1K radius. It'll pop up on a map view of all the eateries, and you can click on that. It'll take you straight to an information page about the restaurant and what they've got to offer.
So, and what sort of, how's it sort of picking this up? Is it picking up from particular apps, or how does it pick it up?
Well, we're providing all the content at the moment as we develop and grow. So we're putting on every event in every city all around the country, things that are happening, whether big or small.
Is that just for Australia, or is this going around the world as well?
It's going to be worldwide, yes. So we've just started small. We're only on the App Store for 3 months. It's a free app. So initially we're going to try and get a foothold here in Australia. We've got people downloading every day, which is really encouraging. It's great. And so they can enjoy it and use it. And then as we develop and grow, it'll be ideally something that for when you go to Barcelona and you arrive and you want to see live music, you'll know exactly where it is on the news feed and on a little map view, which shows a little icon of what's happening around you.
I'm going to Barcelona next week. Is it available?
If only. No, well, just give me another month.
Give me another month, you'd be right.
Hopefully.
How did this come about? What was the catalyst for you coming up with this idea?
Well, just having travelled all my life, I really wanted to. I was in Melbourne, and I didn't know where to go or what to do, and I was trying to Google things, and I just thought it'd be really handy to just have this information pack right there. And also, I wanted to provide, or you know, be able to join other people with maybe like-minded interests. So you can create your own events, and anyone else that shares that same affinity will see that event there. So if you know you want to go cycling with a group of people, you say bike ride through the hinterland or whatever, and anyone else that likes bike riding can see that event, and you can potentially meet up and go for a ride.
So it sort of kind of has viral qualities as well.
Yes, absolutely, yep.
So if people are getting excited about a particular event, does it come up in a stronger way? Like if it, can you see how big the event's going to be?
Yeah, absolutely. If you type on an event, you can check the location and you can see people attending. And so all those people, you, me, everyone, we all have a profile. And you can then click on that person and see if any of your mates are going, and you can get in touch with each other that way if you so desire.
And do you, it, is it, Can you see, so the people that are going, do they have to be have a download of the app?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So if it's
people on the app that you're talking to, like that you're in the community with?
Absolutely, yeah. So anyone that's on the app and has said, yes, I'm attending this event, then if you're attending it too, you can see it as well.
So it's a good idea if you've got a group of friends and you're in a particular place or you're going somewhere and, a different city or something, you can keep in contact with one another. Say, or even a convention or something, a boring old thing like businessmen or something can have this app on their phone. And if everybody in the convention's on it, they can see where everyone's going for dinner that night or something.
That's right. Yeah. If business is actually one of the affinities. That's spot on. We really made it for, people new to an area like international students, travellers, but it's also great for everyone. Like, father was saying that he's going to play golf, and wouldn't it be great if he just had a golf partner and he could just create an event and other people that like golf saw, oh yeah, these guys are playing in Nudgee at 10 a.m. on Thursday. I'll join them.
Yeah, that sounds really good. What's the downloads been like, the take-up of the app?
Well, it's steady. It's been great, actually. The initial response was pretty overwhelming, and we struggled to keep up. It's between 30 and 50 every day so far. So that's.
I'll have to get there and download something. What have been the sort of development timeline and costs involved in doing this?
Well, it's pretty costly, obviously. Technology can be. So we came up with the idea in February last year and went straight to work. And by April, we got in touch with some developers, and they sort of mentored us through the whole process, and it wasn't until the following February that we finally had something ready to go. So that's pretty quick, by all reports, as far as app development goes.
It sounds pretty good to me, but then I've never developed an app. So
yes, well, this is my first one, and the learning curve has been, vertical, very steep.
Talk us through your thought processes when you thought, well, maybe this is a business. How did you get to that point?
Well, my co-founder and I were just discussing, this would be a pretty cool idea, and he sort of forced it on me to say, well, come on, let's find out what we have to do to go about it and see if this is really working. And so then we just sourced developers, and they really challenged us, and the first question they asked us was, what problem are you solving? So it just went from there.
And on this program, on the money, we've actually talked to quite a few people who are new startups, which I suppose you're exactly in that category. One of the things that a lot of people find trouble with is getting financing. How did you go about doing that?
Well, we were lucky in that we both had some initial funds to get it off the ground so that we could have a product to show people. And then we just put ourselves out there to businesses and a few angel investors, friends and family even, and were willing to sell a certain percentage at a certain price, and then suddenly we were worth that much money. So that was what the market dictated. But we did research into other similar things, precedents that had been set from other apps. Set up a business plan and, went out selling ourselves, I guess.
Oh, brilliant. And you decided not to, I presume, put a cost on the download. How has that worked for you, and why did you do it?
Well, we did that because, obviously, the main goal is to get user numbers initially, right? So we're providing all the content. We want people to enjoy it. Then we can go to businesses and say, I've got 15,000 people in Sydney that say they like live music, and you can promote your event and have a little map on the icon for X amount of dollars a day.
So any On The Money listener can get onto the App Store right now, and if you're an Android user, you don't have to wait very long at all to have a look at Affinity and seeing if that will work for you. Anyway, Justin Duncliffe, thank you so much for coming on to the On The Money program. It's been really interesting to hear your story.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Justin Duncliffe there with his new app, Affinity, which could really help you get out and about in that strange city. Well, hello, if you're listening in 3GCR in Gippsland, 4 CRR in Cairns or Huon FM in Hobart. Thanks so much for listening to On The Money. And that's about all the time we have for On The Money this week. We hope you'll tune in again next time to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Thanks to producers Tanya Katsanis, Vincent Su and Jason Lequeyer. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney and broadcast around Australia for the Community Radio Network. Remember, you can find all of our shows and stories on our website 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. We're also on SoundCloud. Search for On The Money. And we're on Twitter and on Facebook at OnTheMoney2SER. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and a venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18. You can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
A lot of people who've been injured in accidents don't get legal advice about compensation because they're afraid of what it will cost. But the truth is, it doesn't need to cost you anything. A specialist injury lawyer could actually fund your case for you. Law Partners is Australia's largest specialist personal injury firm, and it costs nothing to call their local office to get some advice. Call Law Partners on 133 529. Or visit lawpartners.com.au.
2SER sponsors.
World-renowned scientist, humanitarian, conservationist and UN messenger of peace, Dr. Jane Goodall returns to Australia with her message of hope for the future. Think Inc. and the Jane Goodall Institute Australia invite you to enjoy a rare opportunity to witness her on stage on June 23 at the Horden Pavilion. Info and tickets at thinkinc.org.au. Sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
I guess I'll have to change my plan.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27, from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob. It's a hard rain, it's gonna fall.